In the new book, The Age of Eisenhower, America and the World in the 1950s, William Hitchcock, the acclaimed author of The Bitter Road to Freedom, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, reexamines the presidency of Dwight D. Eisenhower. For years, historians regarded Eisenhower as an absentee, do-nothing president, but that judgment has changed. In a 2017 survey, presidential historians ranked Eisenhower fifth on the list of great presidents, behind the perennial top four, Lincoln, Washington, FDR, and Teddy Roosevelt. Historian William Hitchcock explains why this high ranking is justified. As he sees it, Eisenhower's accomplishments were enormous and loom ever larger from the vantage point of our own tumultuous times. William Hitchcock is a professor of history at the University of Virginia and the Randolph Compton Professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs. Again, the name of the book is The Age of Eisenhower, America and the World in the 1950s. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and it's a great pleasure to welcome William Hitchcock to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thanks very much. Great to be with you.
What brought you to want to explore the presidency and this age of Eisenhower?
Well, Eisenhower is, as I talk about in the book, one of the most consequential, one of the most important post-war presidents, but he has often gotten a kind of bum rap. He was thought of at the time and even now as a sort of a placeholder, a guy who got lucky. The 50s was an easy time to be president. He didn't really have to do anything and so forth. But actually, the 50s was a very interesting, complicated time, and Eisenhower was a very skilled leader. So I was interested in unpacking, you know, what made him tick? How did he govern? What were his major achievements? And I felt that his story hadn't really been fully told, and so that's my effort to do that here.
You make the point in the book that so great was his influence on the country and the world that that post-war era up to the presidency of JFK should be known as the age of Eisenhower. You obviously take an entire book to answer what I'm about to ask you, but how do you define that age of Eisenhower?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, you think about the sort of broad sweep of American politics in the mid-century, and you have this period of dramatic expansion of the federal state during the New Deal, the crises of the 1930s and the war years. And then you look at the upheavals of the 1960s, again, a period when Democrats were in the White House, Kennedy and Johnson, facing war and conflict and upheaval. And then there's this kind of middle period of the 50s, really from the end of World War II, 1945, up until the early 1960s, when the United States is recovering from the Second World War, is in some ways the economy is beginning to boom, but it's facing a lot of major issues, major problems, and you know what I think of as the remarkable features of that time. One was the normalization of anti-communism as part of American life. I mean, in the 1950s, communism was seen as a terrible threat to the country, and Eisenhower agreed with that and knitted that into our culture, and that's much of what has to do with the McCarthy period and the Red Scare. He also helped to build out and make normal the warfare state, you know, the presence of a militarized kind of permanent warfare state is something that came to being in the 1950s. Before that time, every time we got into a conflict, well, you would mobilize for war and then demobilize afterwards. In the Eisenhower period, we decided we'd be ready for war at all times, all even in peacetime, and that's something very distinctive about the Eisenhower period.
I want to go back to something that you said at the very beginning when we were talking about his reputation and how he got that reputation and somehow thinking that this post-war period was easy. How did that even come about? Because there was so much that was still percolating and brewing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's an ahistorical observation that people made really from looking at the 50s from the perception of the 1960s and 70s. So if you're in the Vietnam War in the late 60s, or you're facing student unrest and you're facing racial turmoil, or you're facing, say, in the early 70s, the crisis of the Nixon years, or a president that gets wounded essentially in office politically speaking and has to resign, well, the country looked like it was on the brink of a really major crisis. And by comparison, you look back and you say, boy, the 50s was a much simpler time. Look how how placid it was, and Eisenhower was such a kind of a fatherly figure, and everything seemed to be pretty simple. But look at it more carefully, and you see at the beginning there's the Korean War, a very unpopular war and a very dangerous one in which all the world powers were involved in many, many respects, and one that could have gone nuclear at various stages. Then there's the McCarthy period on the home front. Then, of course, there's civil rights turmoil burbling away underneath the surface, ready to break out, and it finally does break out in many ways in the mid-50s. So I think we tend to underestimate the complexities of the decade and think of it as a placid time because people were prosperous, and you know that often lends a sense of comfort. But really, just like any period in American history, there's always crisis lurking around the corner, and Eisenhower had his fair share of them.
What impact did his military background have, do you believe, on his presidency? I know there's been a lot written about this, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but in my reading, it seems that you take a slightly different take on this.
Well, I think his military experience was actually really important. I mean, I can't imagine an Eisenhower without his lifelong career in the military. I like to use the phrase the disciplined presidency. He came into office having run a very large, very complicated bureaucracy, and he figured out how to make it do really hard things. So he took the U.S. Army. He led it from North Africa all the way to the end of World War II, and he had to bring in the British along with him. So he had to figure out how to make the U.S. military, along with their British allies, an effective fighting force, and it was not easy. And it required a lot of skill, a lot of discipline, a lot of compromise, a lot of listening to people who he didn't agree with, bringing in, you know, critics into his inner circle. And those are just the kind of skills that he then was able to apply as president in the White House. He really had a very disciplined way of making decisions. He trusted his cabinet. He used the National Security Council very effectively to come to decisions, to weigh the evidence, to prepare detailed position papers. But he was deeply engaged in the process and then would select a course of action based upon a lot of advice. And those are the kinds of things that a talented, successful military leader would also have done. So I think the two, his military leadership and his presidency, are closely entwined, and they tell us a lot. It tells us a lot about why he was able to run the government pretty effectively in the 50s.
You also talk about the middle path that he was able to forge, even though he was a pretty conservative guy.
Well, it's so interesting. He started out in 1952 running pretty hard to the right. He was a critic of the New Deal. He was a critic of the budget deficits that the Democrats had incurred in the Korean War period. He felt the U.S. government was getting too big and was starting to smother individual initiative. And I think he worried that big deficits would then lead to a crisis in the budget, lead to a crisis in government, and inflation, and so forth. And this would undermine the economic system of the country. Now, that's a candidate speaking, and he was probably a little extreme in his criticisms and in his views of what the legacy of the New Deal really was. But he was very sharp on the campaign trail to try to differentiate himself from the Democratic Party. When he became president, he moderated himself a lot, and that often happens. You often get people who speak extreme things on the campaign trail and then usually tack back to the center. And he wanted to moderate the Republican Party, which was itself divided between internationalists on the one hand and a very conservative isolationist group on the other. And he wanted to try to create a bigger tent for the Republican Party, make it more internationalist, more moderate, and while keeping close to the basic principles of a balanced budget and tight economic policy. So he widened Social Security. He he invested heavily in infrastructure. He believed in public education. He even talked about a national health insurance plan. So there was a kind of good government moderate inside this otherwise quite conservative political figure.
The name of the new book is The Age of Eisenhower, America and the World in the 1950s. It is published by Simon and Schuster, and by William Hitchcock. Tell us a little bit about, because you write a lot about the people who were around him, his confidants, the people who worked with him. Talk about that cast, this cast of characters that you wrote about who had such an influence on Eisenhower and his administration.
Sure. Well, I would say that the, a couple of the figures who he worked with most closely are historic figures of the time. His Secretary of State was John Foster Dulles, who was a very hawkish Republican, a lawyer, who had a distinguished career in international affairs before he became Secretary of State. He was in the job for 7 years, almost more than 7 years, and that's a reminder of the continuity in Eisenhower's administration compared to, for example, today we have a great deal of turmoil and turnover in these positions. But in the Eisenhower period, Dulles ran the State Department for 7 years, and he was very close with Eisenhower. Another key figure who was Eisenhower didn't rely on, but who he met with a great deal and worked with closely was Richard Nixon, the Vice President. And Nixon and Eisenhower had a pretty strange relationship. They were worlds apart. Eisenhower was so successful, so well-known, had such a huge military career. And Nixon was still just starting out on his career, and he was very insecure, and he felt that Eisenhower never took him into his confidence. And I think that's probably true. Nixon kind of resented that Eisenhower didn't give him more to do. Eisenhower had a very, very loyal staff. His chief of staff was named Sherman Adams. He was a former governor of New Hampshire. They called him the abominable no man because he always said no to anybody who wanted to talk to Eisenhower. He really invented the role of chief of staff. That term wasn't even used yet. He was just called assistant to the president. But Sherman Adams was really the first modern chief of staff. And he also had a very effective press secretary, a guy named Jim Haggerty. And what's interesting about Haggerty is he was the press secretary from the first day of the Eisenhower administration all the way to the end of the Eisenhower administration, just one press secretary for 8 straight years. Talk about continuity. So Ike had a team that he knew, that he trusted, that he believed in, and they were very effective in getting his message out to the public. He was really blessed by having skilled professionals around him. There was a lot of stability, a lot of continuity.
What was his feeling about JFK, about the incoming administration, and what he was turning over to this very young, very charismatic man who was really taking the country by storm?
It's so interesting. I think that Eisenhower came to admire John Kennedy, but initially he was very frustrated by Kennedy, and he was very critical of him privately. You have to remember, John Kennedy was the junior senator from Massachusetts. He'd had a short, brief stint in the Navy in the Second World War, but as far as Eisenhower was concerned, he was a punk. He was a nobody. What did he accomplish? Nothing. And so along comes Kennedy from 1956. He's clearly running for president by then, and he's criticizing Eisenhower for being old and boring and stodgy and dull and unimaginative. Kennedy said some remarkably negative personal things about Eisenhower on the campaign trail, and Eisenhower took it personally. He really thought Kennedy was ill-mannered and an uppity youngster, and he said that to many of his friends privately. He was disappointed that Nixon failed to win the 1960 election, bitterly disappointed. He said it was his biggest political failure. But once Kennedy got in and they started meeting, they met a couple of times in the transition and then they met a few times in the early Kennedy administration, I think Eisenhower really came to like him and came to admire him. He saw his great talent, his skill with words, his charisma, his decency, and I think that they made a good pair after all. Kennedy often called Eisenhower for advice during the Bay of Pigs crisis, during the Cuban Missile crisis. So once you're in that job, you're in the smallest club in the world, and they came together pretty quickly.
I asked the question probably out of order because it said a little bit about Nixon and his relationship with Nixon, because you write about this, that obviously Eisenhower felt that he had a pretty good sense for picking winners and losers, and what he thought of Nixon losing to Kennedy.
Yeah, he was devastated by Nixon's loss to Kennedy because he felt that it was the third Eisenhower term, and now the country had turned its back on Eisenhower. But, you know, it was a very, very close election, one of the closest we've ever had, and I don't think Eisenhower should have taken it as quite such a personal rebuke. And remember that Nixon was also a young candidate without a great deal of a track record, and so he wasn't the strongest candidate. And Eisenhower himself was pretty ambivalent about whether Nixon really was the right man for the job. He never said that publicly, of course, but he indicated it in various ways that he thought Nixon was a fine man, but he didn't necessarily think that he was the best man to be president. He never thought of Nixon as anything like his own peer. And so I think it kind of irked him that Nixon might become the second Eisenhower. So although he was very disappointed that Nixon lost in 1960, he didn't do a great deal to help him win. And that's a kind of revealing about Eisenhower's kind of private doubts about whether Nixon really had what it takes to be president.
So bring us back 4 years earlier when Eisenhower decides he's going to run for re-election. And the question of Nixon staying on the ticket is really a question. That is something that is discussed.
Indeed. Eisenhower signaled to Nixon in 100 different ways that he wanted Nixon to step down from being vice president and to take a job either as the Secretary of Defense or Secretary of Commerce. And he said to Nixon, look, you need some practical hands-on experience. You need a big department to run. You need to learn the ropes of government in an executive job, and that will strengthen your case to be president in 1960. And Nixon was much too smart for that, and he knew that, in fact, it would be seen as a demotion and that he would be seen as being kicked out of the second most important job in the country. And so he refused. He refused Eisenhower's suggestion that he move to a cabinet post. Eisenhower didn't order him off the ticket. He didn't want it to be known that he'd ordered him off the ticket. So they had a bit of a stalemate where Nixon just kept saying, no, thanks, I don't want to go to the cabinet. And Eisenhower said, gee, Dick, I think you really ought to. And in the end, Nixon wore him out. And Eisenhower finally just had to accept that Nixon wasn't going to voluntarily step down. He stayed on the ticket. So it's a revealing thing about how Eisenhower wanted something, but he wouldn't demand it. He didn't order Nixon to do what he wanted him to do. And I think that's a little bit of a puzzle. But it does reveal his ongoing doubts about whether Nixon would be the best man to run in 1960.
I know that generally historians are hesitant or shy of wanting to predict the future. I am interested, though, as we trundle through the Trump administration, of how you believe this age of Eisenhower will be looked at in the future.
Oh, I think it's a remarkable period of economic growth, political stability, dignity in the White House. I mean, say what you will, you don't have to agree with Eisenhower's policies, but he carried himself in a way that made the presidency, that honored the presidency. And our politics, though partisan and quite acrimonious in the 1950s, nonetheless were still reasonably dignified. People from the right and the left still talk to one another and still cooperated across party lines pretty regularly. We also waged the Cold War in a way that was very effective. It's true that there were actions that the U.S. took in that period that are seen to be really very extreme, covert operations and coups d'etat and that kind of thing. But on the whole, America came out very strong of the 1950s and held back the Soviet Union and its allies in a very difficult, complicated geopolitical struggle. So looking back on it now, I think it looks like a remarkable time of strong leadership, economic prosperity, political stability. And I think that Eisenhower in particular is a very attractive model for many people who are looking for that great leader who could kind of bring people together from the left and the right and pull the country together a little bit.
Do you think that model can exist today?
Well, I think it's harder, much harder than it used to be, because the two political parties, both of them, always play to the extremes. The middle ground has been eroded, and in both parties. And this is something that right now both political parties are having a major fight about. The Republicans are figuring out, well, should we tack back to the center, because the Tea Party movement's too extreme, or Trump is too extreme? Well, you know, those who say no say, well, we got a Republican in office. We have both houses of Congress. So that's the proof you need. It's effective. Going to the far right is effective. The Democrats, on the other hand, are also having a debate about whether they should be further to the left, or they should move back to the center, and even to the right of the Democratic Party, like Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania, who just won a congressional election by being quite centrist. You know, both parties are searching for the answer, and I don't think the answer is going to be easy to find. I think it's going to be really tough, but I do have a sense that the country, wants both parties to be much more centrist, much more moderate.
The book is fascinating. It is The Age of Eisenhower, America and the World in the 1950s. It is published by Simon & Schuster. William Hitchcock, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Again, William Hitchcock is the author of The Age of Eisenhower, published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.